Hi everybody, I am your host Mohammed Nabil, and this is One Land Many Voices, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. And today we're going to be as close to Jerusalem as we can get. As so many of you know, the presidents of the United States, Donald Trump, on December 6th declared the city of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which is by itself is controversial in the international law, and also declared that he will move the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So that decision has more implications that you can think of, because it's not just like we're moving a building, but it's disrupting an entire tradition of political discourse, and also it affects real people. We're in Portland, Oregon, and we have here our own Portlandian, Rabab. Ahla wa sahla, Rabab.
Hi, Muhammad.
What do you think when it comes to Jerusalem first, before this decision, and Jerusalem after, you know, like growing up in Jerusalem, what that means, and like what did you used to see in Jerusalem?
Well, to start with, let me tell you that this may be, in my personal point of view, like a third or a fourth pivotal moment in Jerusalem's existence. Like, I can't talk much about the first Intifada because I was just a baby, basically, a toddler when that happened. But I do remember, like, faint memories of what that translated on the floor, like, on the ground. Like, one of my memories as a child was, like, going from places that we now call West Bank to Jerusalem. I remember my dad frantically taking the prayer rug and the hatta and putting them on the hood of the car so that in certain areas they recognized us as Arabs, and in certain areas, like, quickly taking them off, and so that the Israeli occupation would let us pass because we had a Jerusalem ID. I was too young to understand that, like, what a yellow license plate, a Jerusalem license plate meant. But, like, that was my memory of the first, like, occupation. And that was, for me, like, the first stop, like, the first transition in Jerusalem, because that was the Jerusalem I grew up in. I grew up in the aftermath of the first Intifada, and I grew up in what used to be Jerusalem, because right now I never hear in the news the word Jerusalem. It's like even our current president calls it East Jerusalem, even when he wants to claim it as a capital. But the reality is, I grew up in a place that was called Jerusalem. There was no East and West, and if there were, the boundaries were kind of vague. I grew up in a whole city. There was no barriers. There were no visible barriers between Jerusalem and the West Bank. And then, you know, the world used to, when I was growing up, like Jerusalem was like the crying call for the Arab world. Like, whoever was being passionate and national, and he would be like, we're gonna free Palestine, we're gonna come and free Jerusalem. And as a girl growing up in Jerusalem, I'm like, okay, like, when is that? How is that gonna happen? And as a kid, I remember when I started listening to the news and asking my mom, what's Fatah and Hamas? And she was like, oh, these are two Palestinian factions, and they're like fighting to who actually is the leader of Palestine. And Muhammad, I swear, I was like, yeah, No longer than 7. And I told her, Mama, shouldn't we like win Palestine before we fight over who? Who gets to, like, sit on top?
Yeah.
Like, shouldn't we, like, get together first? I was really naive. But that was, like, the Jerusalem I grew up in Like, now I'm older, I can tell you about the racial inequalities that was there then, before even the second intifada happened. I can tell you that I grew up in a place where I'm a permanent resident, where my parents were born there with a permanent residency. We are born with a dual status. Like, by law, the law for a Palestinian Muslim or Christian born in Jerusalem is different than the law that is written for a Jewish citizen of Jerusalem.
Yeah, speaking of that, I really want you to talk about, like, what's a Palestinian living in Jerusalem in regards of, like, status, you know, like, what is the permanent residency means, what the Israelis do to the permanent residents, you know, like, what are the laws, like, that face Palestinians who live?
So, before the second intifada, the permanent residency status was not put as a higher status for Palestinians as much. But once the wall was built, once that apartheid wall was built, then that status started taking much more of a shape and weight in terms of, for example, like I said before, a Palestinian from the get-go since 1967, it was known. If you are born a Palestinian in Jerusalem, then you are born with a permanent residency. And you go by a different law than if you were born Jewish, and by default, you get to be a citizen. We go by the military law, while they go by the civilian law. You can imagine any small punishment for any small offense that any human being might take. Like, let's say, I'm not going to even say throwing a rock. Let's just say not taking, like, crossing the light when it's yellow, speeding in traffic, not having your signal on while taking an exit. We get scrutinized for every single thing that we do. It's double standard in everything. Like, one of the simplest things that I can tell you is language. When you are born in a place that is unwelcoming to you in every single thing, starting your language. When I am born a permanent resident and Israel tells me, no, you don't need to learn Hebrew. You can learn whatever you want. Keep your Arabic and learn whatever you want, but you don't need to learn Hebrew. And then, on the other hand, it gives me every bank statement in Hebrew. It gives me every payment in Hebrew. Every application I have to go is in Hebrew. Whatever company I'm going to enlist to is in Hebrew. Moving on to boycott, which is happening right now, there's no way for a Palestinian living in Jerusalem to do something as boycott, because when I worked in the Israeli Ministry of Education, my taxes go directly to Israel. And if I want to have a decent living, if I want to have what is a living. One other thing that's very different from being born a Palestinian in Jerusalem than being born any other thing is a law that is called the center of your life. That is a law that I had the privilege of being subjected to quite a few times. The center of your life law means that as a permanent resident of Jerusalem, everything I do in my life has to be centered around Jerusalem. Meaning, if I sought education abroad, if I sought work abroad, or if I sought marriage abroad, anything that may be beneficial for my future is the thing that would be the excuse for Israel to tell me, oops, sorry, you've been out of the country for X numbers of years, and we don't have your number anymore. You should go back to where you just were. That happened to me twice. Once when I was in the University of Jordan, and I was too young to understand what my parents was doing. I had just graduated from the university, and my parents were like, for 3 months, running around, gathering papers, and like, you have to do this, you have to get your papers, or And I was like, why? And she was like, okay, you need to go to this university. You need to go to call this. And you need. And I'm like, why? She's like, you're going to lose your social security. And you have like, there had been like a rebate of like $10,000 at me. And they had to deduct it and do all of those loops to prove that I live here again. I didn't recognize that, but I got another harder encounter with this when I came to live in the U.S., actually.
Elaborate more about, like, you're married to an American citizen here in Portland, and, like, you visited in the last 2 or 3 years, 2 times or 3 times. So what has changed in the last visit?
Okay, well, to give you that context, I need to just back up one bit. During the Second Intifada, that's when the language started changing in Jerusalem, and I came back to what they now call East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem, and I refuse to call it that because it's one city. That's number one. I left a sectarian, like a liberal city, like religion was not the main core. You could be whoever you wanted to be in that city. And I came back to a very divided city. I don't know how to explain it, but if you're from Jerusalem, you kind of get normalized to the oppression that you see. And it happens so slow, or it used to happen so slow, that like you just take one thing at a time and you cope with it, and then take another thing at a time and you cope with it. But, and that's the Jerusalem I left. I left a Jerusalem where everything was difficult to do.
And when did you leave?
I left in 2012. Mm-hmm. Everything was really hard. Being a teacher was getting, I'm a teacher and so is my mom. And I left a Jerusalem where technology, quote unquote, was starting to come to our schools. And by quote unquote, I mean to say that, again, being in a city where there's two sets of laws, you can imagine the education being the same. So our education standard were third world. Well, if you ask me where I work and I tell you Jerusalem, you're going to think Israel standards, which would make it leap into a first world standard. Not for Palestinians, not for Arabs in Jerusalem. And that's a very important thing to say, because the differences I see in Muhammad is differences I see in my immediate life. I notice stuff. One of the main things I noticed, like, life was always difficult. It's always been hard to go and do any sort of paperwork, any sort, going and paying your gas bill, your water bill, your electricity bill, going to the goddamn mailbox was a hassle, going to fix your phone is a hassle, because you only have certain places. You live in Jerusalem where your day off is Friday, their day off is Saturday, and your day off is, like, you have to maneuver every weekend in order to get your shit done, and then you barely do it, maneuver to get your stuff done, and then you barely get to do it anyways. But we call that the normal. Like, the normal oppression. That used to be the normal. I leave Jerusalem. And let me talk about changes that happened before I talk about my experience with this. The changes that happened were I had to go through a day where I went through to certain municipalities. I had to go to the bank and to the phone office. And other departments. And one main thing I noticed was that they had changed every single teller in every single place that I worked. I had to witness my dad in Ramadan being teary-eyed, looking at a person telling me that he had gone 3 times to that same place. Not one person spoke to him in Arabic. Not one person spoke to him in English. What that means to me when I ask dad, when I ask my aunt who 2 years ago couldn't go to her cancer radiations when the war was going on Gaza. What I gather from all of this stuff is how the case of Jerusalem is different. They can't just mass kill you. They can't just grab land and claim it's the West Bank and dispute it in the, it's Jerusalem. So what they can do is make life so unlivable. Like, what I saw was in 2016, and no pretense from Israel. Like, at least what I call 2012, there was a pretense that in terms of, like, the public, like, they had, Israel had a slightest bit of pretense that you guys are human, you Palestinians. What I saw in 2016 was Israel does not, like, doesn't see it. We know that we were never seen as human, but what I saw was we're making life so unbearable, so miserable. We have, like, why don't you die? That was the message I got. Like, why don't you miserable people just drop dead? Like, we're doing everything we can to make your life a living hell.
How do you see, like, the segregation in Jerusalem mirror, like, the segregation here in the U.S.?
Oh, it's very, very, very similar. There's a lot of similarities. And again, it depends on where you look. In some areas where they... Well, Portland is a great example for this, actually. Elaborate. Portland is the history of Portland is for it to be a white state. Oh, Israel is made to be a Jewish state. Like... You cannot choose the kind of people. Like, people are people. We are all one race. We're a human race. You cannot divide people based on color just as much as you cannot divide people based on religion. That's one. Number two, when I talk about, we have jokes the same way that here my black friends have jokes. Laughing while Palestinian, driving while Palestinian, coughing while Palestinian, all of those jokes that, like, oh, you could actually die because you took a wrong lane, because you actually gave a look that you weren't supposed to, because the way I see a Palestinian in Israel is very close to the way I see a black person in a rural conservative place in a Republican area. In gentrification is a very, very, very close term to what happens in Jerusalem, because actually, thank you for bringing that up, because gentrification in Portland and what I see is happening in Portland is the way that they are doing it in Jerusalem to Palestinians. There's differences. There's, like, differences. Yeah. So. Well, okay. I went to this talk in Kennedy School a few years back, and it was about the history of North and Northeast Portland, and they were talking about the highway that was built I don't know how many years back, and that where that highway was, that used to be a black neighborhood, where the Moda Center is. My the grandpa that I work with was telling me that it used to be like a black neighborhood that he lived in. That directly translates to me, because where I live right now, there's a highway right in front of, like, I exit the little street that's in my house and I'm at a highway. That highway, where it is right now, there used to be a church and a parking lot and a playground and so many houses of my neighbors. There's no playground, there's no parking lot, there is no houses, and now the church is on one side and the building that belonged to it are on the other side of the highway. And the reason was the same. What was the reason they gave? Like, the reason was, like, we needed to make a highway for, like, the betterment of the city. And, like, what people, who in the city? And who are you considering when you're doing this thing that would benefit the city? Like, it's kind of a very direct, like, when I listened to that one example, I was, like, shocked to my core. the way that they, again, it happens in different terms because the people in power are the things that are controlling are different. But here, the way that people become homeless is by foreclosures and banks. There, it's by not being permitted to fix your window or to dig a well in your backyard. And even though this is your land, even though you did every single thing legal for that to be done, yeah, and they still...
About, like, if like you're a person in Jerusalem, like you've lived in this house for... Like your family's been in this house for more than 100 years...
Mm-hmm.
And your window got broken. Like, what's the process that you need to go through in order to fix that window or, like, change your door?
Well, I cannot tell you that I personally had to do that. My parents had, like, handled all of that stuff. And I'm privileged. I was lucky enough to be in an area where that was not under scrutiny or under the eye until, like, we started becoming in the news, like... 7-8 years ago. You know, it happens slowly, like it's like a big circle that keeps like getting closer and closer and closer, because we're like, our neighborhood is one of the last neighborhoods that they we're surrounded by settlements. I don't know how else to describe it to you. Like, where there used to be land in front of my house, there's now a settlement being built. Literally across from the highway that I just told you about, there's now a settlement being built. I know, like, it depends on what area you are in. It depends if the area you are in is an area of interest to Israel. Because if it's not an area of interest to Israel, you can simply fix it. But if it is a contested area, or if it's an area that where they gave you orders of demolition or orders of like, this land is protected, this is one very good excuse that they use, especially like that happens in areas that are much closer to the old city than mine, like Silwan, Bab el Amoud. These places, they're in the heart of the old city, they're in the heart of Jerusalem. I'm in the suburbs. If you go to Jerusalem, the old city, I can tell you when I went this visit, I went to the old city and I asked quite a few shopkeepers because I noticed quite a few differences in the old city. I noticed that where you walk along the alleyways where there used to be open space, there's now it's tarped in as if you're walking in Hebron.
Mm-hmm.
That When I saw the like when I noticed the darkness, I looked up, I saw that it's fenced up, and the first thing I thought to my mind, I'm like, oh my God, did the settlers already buy the houses that are on the second floor in the middle of the old city? So I started asking questions, and the answer was yes. The answer was that in the old, and I asked three different shopkeepers, Muhammad, not one. One of them was 14, one of them was in his 30s, and the other was in his 50s or 60s. And the three of them said like kind of the same rhetoric, which is because they are in the old city and they are trying to Judaize the old city, every single month the rents are being raised on them. In Arabic, it's called asar ta'jiziyya. It's like impossible prices. The other thing they told me is that they are not allowed to fix anything. They need a permit. They need to go and submit everything to the Jerusalem municipality. And we don't have any representatives. And it has to go through like permits. You have to to do a lot of paperwork in order to get the permit to fix, because you're in the holy city. And they don't let them fix. And what the three of them told me is that we still fix, because if your pipe is leaking and your bathroom is overflowing, you need to fix it. And if your window is broken, you need to. So they fix it. And Israel is waiting for them to fix it. That's why they're not giving them that permit, so that they do fix it, because they're in that need. And that would be their excuse. Oh, you violated Israeli law. Now we get to take your house.
I know that you've been in the last month in Jerusalem, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
What's happening in Jerusalem during that month? You know, what's happening to the holy sites?
I didn't go to Al-Aqsa because it was Friday and it was in the middle of Friday prayer. Mm-hmm. So take what I'm saying with a grain of salt. I entered all of the old city, but I didn't go to the Haram. What I did see was that even before you enter, like, you know how there's many gates to Jerusalem?
Yeah.
A few of them already lay in what they now call West Jerusalem. But there was a couple of gates that were Arab gates, you know? Bab al-Zahre and Bab al-Amud. They were two gates. Like, Bab al-Zahre was the gate that gets you to Al-Aqsa. And Bab al-Amud was the gate that gets you to... that gets you to the markets, that gets you to the Muslim quarter and the Christian quarter and all of, like, the maze that is the old city. So what I did notice is it's super intense, the amount of army presence in on the street, like on the street of Bab al-Amud. They're like, they have overlooking the old city. Platform, there were like 5-6 soldiers. One of them was taking a selfie of himself with us poor people in the back. And then you go down the stairs, and before you enter the gates of the old city, you see another platform on your left and another platform on your right, and both of them have soldiers. And again, like, they're, it's not like they have their guns.
So it's a more of a very militarized
it's
scene.
It's like very heavily militarized.
I want to, like, we mentioned this point earlier, but I want to touch more into it because it's really important. Like, in a state like the state of Israel claims to be like the only democracy in the Middle East, how can a permanent residency lose their permanent residency in Jerusalem? Like, what's the process? Like, why do you lose your presidency?
Well, the state of Israel was built on the basis of it's Jewish and democratic. Like, that statement that's so hypocritical in its core that it's hard to have a conversation after. But that's the claim that that Israel has, that it's Jewish first and democratic second. And that's the basis of why I am not a citizen of Jerusalem. Jerusalem has always been, like, whether we agreed or not, whether the world, like, whether Trump came out and said it, Israel never needed anybody's permission to declare Jerusalem the state as its capital. If I say I'm from Jerusalem, every single person automatically thinks I'm Israeli. A permanent residency status can be lost because you were not born a citizen. And because if you are a country born to be Jewish and democratic, then you need to have your demography. It's a numbers game. And in this numbers game that Israel actually now won because Trump declared Jerusalem the capital of Israel, in this numbers game, we Palestinians are numbers. And it's kind of trickier than how they do it in other places. For us, it's the law. And the law says that when you leave if you leave 3 years consecutively, whether you visit or not, you are in jeopardy of losing your permanent residency status, period. That's the law. The center of your life has to be Jerusalem. It even applies if you are to be married to a person from the West Bank, which is the status quo for a lot of people.
Talk about half an hour trip. So, like, you're still, like, leaving your own home base, and the center of your life is not Jerusalem, it's somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So, therefore, you're out?
Yep. Therefore, they have the right to, at some point, it's like, I don't know when it's going to happen, but it's like, I'm on a clock right now. At some point, they will come and tell me, oh, sorry, we don't have your number here anymore. Like, you know, we've crossed you from our list. You can have a visa if you want and visit. And then by them giving me a visa, I will be subjected to what any other traveler to Palestine will be subjected to. And if I, God forbid, have any inkling to what they want to deem as anti-Israel, then they will not let me see my parents. They will deny me the right to go back home. Like, it's the most ridiculous thing ever. Like, I it would be something different if like if you were born anywhere in the world, it could be the worst place ever, but and you could choose to leave forever. But at any point you say, okay, I'm tired of this, all of this adventure, I just want to check back on that horrible place that I grew up in, you get to go. Like, we don't, because my existence is a number. I'm a number. And by me going out, plus the law that says center of my likes equals blah, 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 it gives them the premises to kick me out. One less Palestinian in Jerusalem. And one of the things that Trump did that really will translate to, it's gonna, the repercussions are really gonna be, I'm just gonna have to wait and see. But what Trump did is basically hand Netanyahu the biggest gift he wanted. Palestinians in Jerusalem, we are a majority, but now most of our majority is surrounded by walls one way or another. We are surrounded by checkpoints one way or another. So the actual people who are free and still like have the freedom of movement in what they call Jerusalem are very few. And with this decision, and with Netanyahu and his government proposing bills in their Israeli Knesset about annexing 5 Palestinian Jerusalem places and giving them to the West Bank, and putting 5 the 5 settlements that are close around Jerusalem, adding them to Jerusalem, that shifts the demography that I was telling you about. That shifts Jerusalem demography to being Jewish. And I don't know what will happen to my permanent residency or to my parents' status or anything.
We always learn from the people of Jerusalem that they are never giving up. And that's like something that's been there for years. The struggle for justice is never an injustice. And people are on the ground and the people are resisting. And like, that's something, you know, at least that's the only hope that I can see. You know?
We are stubborn people, Muhammad. Yeah. We exist even if it's just to defy.
Yep. The spirit can be up and can be uplifted.
It's always darkest before dawn.
Yep. Well, thanks very much. This is like our interview with Rabab from Portland. She's a resident of Portland, a resident of Jerusalem for now. And hopefully we'll see you next time. Stay tuned. Journal of the hard times, tales from the dark side, evidence of the settlements on my hard drive. Man, I swear my heart died at the end of that car ride when I saw that checkpoint. All right, that was Jasiri X with Checkpoint. Now, I'm very pleased to be moving on to our next segment, and that is a conversation I had recently with Richard Falk. Richard is the former United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories occupied since 1967. He is also a professor emeritus of international law at Princeton University, and he has been teaching at UC Santa Barbara. All right, Richard, I wanted to talk to you about this first question because it's come up really hard-hitting in the last week or so. Trump's announcement that the U.S. is going to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and is going to move its diplomatic embassy to the city of Jerusalem. Now, he's justified this by saying that Israel is the only country in the world that is not allowed to locate its capital in a national city of its own choice. What's the problem here, Richard?
Well, there are a number of problems. For one thing, there's an international consensus that Trump's announcement broke to the effect that no change in the status of Jerusalem would be made until the parties themselves, in other words, Israel and Palestine, reached an agreement as to how they would share control over the city. And that was understood to be something that would be deferred until the last stages of a supposed peace negotiation. So that's one aspect of what's wrong and disruptive about it. The other is the fact that Israel is trying to establish a capital in an occupied territory is basically not its own territory. the assumption being made by the Israeli assertion is that Jerusalem as a totality is part of Israel. But the whole international law understanding of the status of Jerusalem is that it is not resolved as to its proper legal status, and in the interim, it's occupied territory, at least so far as East Jerusalem is concerned, and the whole of Jerusalem is in a kind of legal abeyance. So that you have two big problems there.
Mm-hmm. When you're talking about this, I kept thinking, well, okay, but there's this relationship, or what is the relationship between this and what you're saying and the fact that Israel has no problem at all making this move that it decided to make, and that they did it years ago. They actually, decades ago, stated their intention to actually make the capital Jerusalem. But now there's this whole thing that's developed where they have the sanction of the big dog in the world, the U.S. imperialists. And there's this whole question of the relationship between what they've decided to do and the fact that Israel has no problem doing it, since it actually has refused. I mean, it's actually refused to define its borders. It's probably the only country in the world that has refused to define its borders in all these decades.
Yes, exactly, because there's the tension between Israel as a established political entity and the ambitions of Israel to satisfy the maximal Zionist vision of biblical Israel, which extends at least to the West Bank and the whole of Jerusalem. So there's always been that tension, and Israel has cleverly avoided committing itself publicly to this vision of a greater Israel, which is a direct confrontation with the international consensus, and to the establishment of its own legitimacy back in 1948, when it was accepted as an independent state on the basis of General Assembly Resolution 181, which was a division of the territory of mandated Palestine between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and even at that time was considered by the Arab world, and certainly by the Palestinians, to be a highly unfair territorial allocation.
Yeah, and that leads me into this question, because I remember speaking to you over the years and reading things that you've written and then studying the situation in general. There is this particular importance in relation to the West Bank and how Israel views that. And it's very much, and it's also true, I guess you'd have to say about Gaza too, when you look at the seemingly never-ending attacks on Gaza, that it's very much bordering on a denial of the existence of Palestine and the Palestinian people, Palestine as a legitimate state, and the Palestinian people as a legitimate people.
No question. I mean, that's the from the very beginning. See, it's not really the puzzle challenging Zionism was, how do we get rid of the Palestinian majority? Remembering that when the Balfour Declaration 100 years ago was issued, the Jewish population of Palestine was no more than 6% at the most. And even at the end of World War II, when the partition resolution was adopted, the Jewish population of Palestine was only 33%. And to make Israel fulfill the Zionist vision of a democratic and Jewish state meant they had to establish a Jewish majority. And the only way they could do that was to get rid of most of the Palestinians. And the so-called Nakba, or dispossession of the Palestinians that occurred in the 1947-48 war, achieved that result. But it's been a continuous process of how do we deal with this demographic so-called ticking bomb without repudiating our legitimacy claims that rest on being a liberal democracy. And increasingly, as they move toward this unilateral end of the conflict, they've abandoned any serious claim of being a democratic state as distinct from a kind of ethno ethnocratic state. It's clearly intended to be a Jewish state, and the idea of democracy and human rights is definitely subordinated, and that's why we concluded in our UN study that Israel's structure of control over the Palestinian people as a whole really rested on apartheid structures of victimization and subjugation based on ethnic identity.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that, and I spent a lot of time studying apartheid in South Africa and had written about it, had gone there when it was an apartheid state and interviewed all kinds of people about the situation. And one of the things that struck me, though, is in terms of, like, I was just thinking as you're talking about, you know, this point about what, how Israel has reacted to or acted upon the Palestinian people. One of the, it's true that there's a lot in common there, which we should talk about now, I guess, actually, the point about, you've talked about apartheid in South Africa and how it applies to Israel and the Palestinian people. But I also think that there is this element of, I mean, it's sort of like ethnic cleansing in a certain sense that they've done with the Palestinian people, where they don't need the Palestinian people and they don't really want them. And so this whole thing has been unleashed.
And they've struck, and in that sense, it's very different because the South African economy was premised on cheap African labor.
Mm-hmm.
Israel has deliberately not wanted to base its economic viability on Palestinian labor for precisely the reasons you suggest, that they want to get rid of as many Palestinians as possible. And ethnic cleansing is the gentlest accurate word for what happened in 1947-48, which meant the expulsion of 700,000 to 750,000 Palestinians and the denial of any right of return, regardless of how deep the connections of the Palestinians were with the land and with family and other connections.
Talking today with Richard Falk. Richard is a former United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. He's also an American Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University. Israel has been pretty open about what it's doing today in relation to Jerusalem. And that actually even went back to 1980, where they actually were pretty open about, look, this is going to be our capital city. You don't like it. Tough.
Yes, but they were saying that, but even the U.S. refused to endorse that. See, and what's different now is that the Trump diplomacy, such as it is an unconditional endorsement of what Israel was unilaterally proclaiming ever since 1967, essentially.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get into with you. I really wanted to hear your thoughts on that, because it does seem like, you know, look, the U.S. Congress, I mean, they even passed an act that, what was it, the Jerusalem Embassy Act. If, you know, people were just thinking about it now, but actually the U.S. Congress in the 90s passed this, the Jerusalem Embassy Act, which basically recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital back then.
Yes, and that's another interesting dimension of all of this, that the Congress was basically playing domestic politics, because they didn't try to tie the executive's hand, and they always connected it to U.S. security and other considerations. But they wanted at the same time to please the Zionist and pro-Israeli lobby and so on. And this was a good symbolic way of doing that without paying any cost. And it shows domestically how much the Palestinians have suffered, because they had no countervailing power to the Israeli well-organized and well-funded lobbies. And you get a very distorted policy, national policies, whenever you have that kind of one-sidedness on the domestic political scene, and an issue is very fundamental for an influential ethnic or religious group within American society.
What do you mean by that one-sidedness?
Well, what I mean is that you have no, for instance, in the relationship to Greek wishes with respect to the Aegean, there was always, or with Cyprus is a better example, Greek aspirations with regard to Cyprus were always balanced by U.S. concerns about NATO and preserving a positive relationship with Turkey. And so even though it's the domestic scene was favorable to the Greek pressures, they were always neutralized by this strategic interest in keeping Turkey from being too unhappy. Same thing with the Armenian issue.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this. You said, and I'm trying to really figure this out because I know that there's all this, you know, you've spent a lot of your life actually digging into this and really speaking out in ways that were extremely important in exposing this. And international law, I read somewhere where international law says that East Jerusalem is occupied territory. And therefore,
yes,
whatever is done in relation to it is subject to the Fourth Geneva Convention. But it appears that it's not really, you know, that doesn't seem to matter anything to anybody.
Well, what you're really saying indirectly is that geopolitics trumps, and that's a bad...
It's good.
bad pun, trumps international humanitarian law. And that when there's a sufficiently strong geopolitical move, the U.S. and other countries push international law to one side, and that happens particularly in relation to security issues and war peace issues. Doesn't happen so much in the commercial trade investment issues or maritime safety and a whole series of things where international law works pretty well. It doesn't work well where hard power is part of the nexus of the problem or the core of the problem. And that's been the case in all of these territorial conflicts. And the Zionist movement and Israel as a state has been very opportunistic in the way in which it's disguised its real goals and pursued them stage by stage. You know, going back again to the Balfour Declaration, where they were only aspiring to achieve a homeland within the established entity of Palestine, of which they were a small minority, as I said earlier, to then wanting to be a state in accordance with the partition conception, to then wanting to be a state that could encroach upon the occupied Palestinian territory and become a state that was larger than what was envisioned either by partition or by the end of the so-called War of Independence in 1948. So at every stage, Israel has escalated its real demands beyond what its public posture had been at an earlier stage.
Mm-hmm. And tell me this.
And that makes it extremely difficult for the ordinary person to understand the progression and escalation of Israeli ambitions because they weren't publicly visible. The full extent of them were not publicly visible until very recently. And now with the green light given by the Trump administration, they've become more and more visible.
Yeah, exactly. Now, tell me this. You know, there's a point here that this idea, I guess, that it poses a question, that, and I think you've posed this question yourself, that does any state actually really have the right to establish its capital in a city that's occupied or in a territory that's occupied, that is actually occupied, is not, you know, and is recognized as occupied, you know, across the world and through the bitter experience of the people who live there?
The short answer to the first question is, of course not. Imagine if East Germany or the Soviet Union had extended Berlin to include a significant part of West Berlin. There would be World War III.
Mm-hmm.
See, and they were both occupied portions of a once unified and again now unified city. But the whole notion of occupation is incompatible with claiming territorial rights in that political entity that is, by international understanding, occupied.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And by being occupied means it's not subject to sovereign control. And to have a capital city presupposes complete sovereign control. You've never heard of a capital in a place where the sovereign government didn't have plenary legal, political, and cultural control.
Yeah, right. Right, exactly. Good point. Yeah. Well, tell me this, and this is related to that. So then out of this situation, there actually has been a campaign that's kind of going on over the years to not just verbally, and I know this is something you've really delved into, but to not just verbally, but physically, actually physically do away with the Palestinian population in whatever means was necessary.
Yeah, but do away has been somewhat ambiguously implemented and may mean different things to different strands of the Israeli leadership. One meaning of do away is to effectively subjugate, whether the Palestinians are treated as a minority, discriminated minority in Israel, or as a captive population in Gaza, or as an insecure residents of Jerusalem, or as a occupied West Bank, or as permanent consignment to refugee or involuntary exile status. So one whole sense of what it means to get rid of the Palestinians is to subjugate and effectively control. The other, which is overlaps with this, is to seek to avoid a demographic ambiguity by the growth of Palestinian population, by actually physically getting rid of Palestinians to the extent possible. And one of the ways this is currently being considered within Israel is to somehow get rid of Gaza as part of the Palestinian entity and persuade either Egypt or Jordan to absorb and administer Gaza either as part of their own territory or as some sort of protectorate within their territory. This effort has so far failed, but it's indicative of this effort to combine, on the one side, ethnic cleansing with, on the other side, complete subjugation.
Yeah, and I think you just answered the last question I was going to ask you, which was where do things stand now in the wake of the Trump machine and what it's doing? And I think this point about, look, it's a very bad situation for the Palestinian people. It's a very bad situation for people all around the world who, if we allow that to happen, if we allow what they're doing to happen, if there's not a massive wave of opposition to this, both inside Israel, inside the Palestinian territories, all of this, and inside here, where actually, Trump is actually the first president to actually not talk about the, doing this, but to actually do it. And what it means in terms of the world, it's a terrible escalation of the rule of U.S. imperialism around the world and the suffering of people in Palestine, the Palestinian people, but also what it means to people all over the world who we lose some of our own humanity if we stand there and just allow yet another genocidal assault to go on.
No, I completely agree with you, Michael. I mean, it's a precedent for that precisely that kind of unilateral geopolitical militarism or iron fist geopolitics, where law and morality are completely marginalized, and a bunch of calculations have been made. See, I think two of the things that are different in the Trump presidency is, first of all, intensifying these dysfunctional special relationships that pre-existed Trump with Israel and Saudi Arabia. And secondly, this pandering in an even more extreme way to the major Israeli donors within the United States and the Christian Zionists who have somehow wrapped up their own expectations of the second coming of Jesus with the transcendence of Israel as a renewed biblical state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. All right, Richard, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, as ever, I enjoyed it, Michael, and your questions led to a very good conversation.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed talking with you, man. And we'll do it again soon, all right?
Great.
All right, Richard,
take care.
You too, man. Bye now.
Bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Richard Falk. Richard is the former United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. He's also an American Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University, and he's also held a position at UC Santa Barbara. And we've been talking with Richard about what's the significance of Trump's announcement that the U.S. will now recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. What does it mean for the Palestinian people? All right, we're running up on our time, so I want to be real quick with this, but I want to make sure that I thank everyone that helped make this show possible today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op, Teddy Robinson, and all of you who tune in each and every week and stay tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we're going out with something that back when I was a kid really made me think, and today has even more pressing importance than ever. And that is Eve of Destruction, but this is by Public Enemy. Talk to you again next week.